Good? Okay.
Yeah, all right. Mayor Protem, Honorable Paul Roten presenting.
All right, please have a seat. I think we had a miscommunication there with Madam Clerk and I. Sorry for us keeping you waiting. Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. May it please the Court. Your Honor asked us to focus on portions of our trial brief that dealt with enterprise value and to address KIC's failure to close theory. So that's what I intend to cover this afternoon.
Thank you.
Your Honor, KIC's argument can be simply stated as, but for defendant's advice, KIC would have bought out Solston in 2013 or 2015, preserved Marsh Creek's peak value, and avoided everything that followed. But to be clear, KIC is not seeking compensation for something it lost. It's asking to be paid for something it never had. It never owned, it never bought, and it never financed. Indeed, it's asking the court to ignore what actually occurred with a failing business and instead imagine an alternate reality to justify tens of millions of damages to which it's not entitled. That theory fails at three independent levels, any one of which is fatal. First, it's not pleaded in the complaint. Second, KIC cannot establish causation as a matter of fact or law. And third, it would produce an impermissible double recovery, even if causation were assumed here. And the court need not accept defendant's version of events. The theory collapses under KIC's own pleadings and evidence. And I'll walk through each of those points. But it's also important as we approach this to step back and think about this from a common sense perspective. KIC faults defendants for doing what lawyers are supposed to do, protect their client from overpaying for a company that was basically bankrupt 2 years later. Thank goodness KIC didn't pay millions for Marsh Creek, when we now know with certainty that the business failed. Your Honor, I'd like to suggest to the court framing the legal question that the court must answer, because the way KIC presents the issues risks blurring three distinct concepts. First is what Rule 55 establishes. Second, what the complaint actually pleads. And third, what Alaska law actually allows as compensatory damages. As the court has made plain, again this morning, this is a Rule 55 damages hearing following a discovery sanction. It's not a merits trial. It's not an invitation to supply new liability theories. And it's not an exercise in hindsight economics. Rule 55 establishes liability only as to the well-pleaded factual allegations in the complaint. It does not establish unpleaded theories. It does not establish hypothetical transactions. And it does not establish alternate business histories that appear for the first time in expert or other affidavits, not the complaint.
Is that enterprise value?
Yes, Your Honor. And the failure to close in particular. And the limitation is particularly important here because failure to close is not a category of damages in the complaint. It's a counterfactual explanation that KIC now advances to justify an entirely new damages category, which is the loss of equity value in Marsh Creek. As Your Honor knows, the complaint pleads one core malpractice theory. It's that strict foreclosure. That breaks down into advice concerning the secured loans that KIC made to Marsh Creek in 2017 and 2018, the foreclosure on Marsh Creek's assets in 2018 after Marsh Creek defaulted, and the use of Marsh Creek's assets to form new 8A subsidiaries. It's in the complaint, the theory of the malpractice and strict foreclosure, paragraphs 30 to 54. But what the complaint does not plead is equally important. It does not allege the defendants caused a buyout to fail. It does not allege that KIC had the ability to finance a buyout.
Say that once more.
The complaint does not allege that KIC had the ability to finance the buyout. Your Honor asked a question about that this morning, and I'm going to talk about that in more detail as we look at KIC's cash position and even the interest alone that would have been necessary to pay to get that kind of a deal and whether KIC had the ability to do so. Mm-hmm. It didn't.
I will be looking for communications from your clients to the board expressing that opinion to the extent you give me one today.
Okay, understood. Your Honor, the complaint also does not allege that Solson would have accepted a particular price, nor does it allege that Marsh Creek's 2013 to 15 value could have been preserved. And in fact, paragraph 24 of the complaint pleads the opposite. It says KIC made an initial offer, and then it says Solson did not accept it. That allegation matters. It acknowledges that the deal did not close because the parties did not agree, not because lawyers failed to paper it. And, Your Honor, you've already done the work here. In your December 24th order, which, Stephanie, if you wouldn't mind putting it up to tab 2.
And which book should I be working
from? You should have a new book for this afternoon. Right. On the second page.
So tab 1?
So this is tab 2, Your Honor. It's your December 24th order.
Perfect.
And on the second page. If you can blow up that top paragraph, the additionally paragraph. In your order, the court was identifying the categories of damages supported by the complaint. And you were describing the different allegations and the enterprise damages. And you said KIC offers support for these enterprise damages, such as substantial additional losses to KIC as KIC invested to spool up the entities it formed to operate in the government contracting area upon the advice of Holland and Knight, or its request for damages generally and exemplary damages in its complaint. It appears to the court that the loss of enterprise value damages are limited to the dissolving of Marsh Creek, lost contracts, investment costs to spool up the entities KIC formed to operate in the government contracting area upon the advice of Holland and Knight attorneys, and other such damages KIC enumerates in their amended complaint that resulted from H&K's malpractice and breach of fiduciary duty. Nothing there about the loss of equity value in Marsh Creek, because it's not in the complaint.
How do you differentiate that from enterprise value?
I think Your Honor correctly identified that what's in the complaint with respect to enterprise value means something different than the loss of the equity value. They've taken that term and applied it more broadly than the complaint reflects. As your order indicated, the concept of enterprise value as reflected in the complaint is limited. It's those costs. And we're talking about in Dr. Colt's, their expert affidavit, those would be items 2 through 7, mm-hmm. not 1A and 1B. 1A and 1B are the loss of the equity value in Marsh Creek. That's not in the complaint.
Equity value.
Equity value, the loss of the equity value. Mm-hmm. And that's really the core of what we've heard from KIC is their enterprise value claim. It's not in the complaint. It's taking advantage of an opportunity to broaden the scope of this case in a Rule 55 proceeding, which is inappropriate. And there's nothing in the complaint tying damages to a hypothetical 2013 or 15 buyout. Your Honor,
Say that again?
There's nothing in the complaint that ties any damages to a hypothetical 2013 or 2015 buyout.
In I guess in what way?
Well, what we've heard today is Your Honor, the KIC would like you to award damages, which they call enterprise value, but has been described clearly as the loss of their equity value.
Sure.
And they've asked you to do that based on a 2013 valuation and a 2015 valuation. There's no reference to those in the complaint. There's nothing in the complaint that suggests that that's a measure of damages in this case.
Sure. Yeah, and I guess it needs to be set. I guess I should let you know my thoughts on that. It seems like advice given over a period of time had various results is what it seems like. That's how it seems like it was pled. The advice along the way involved We didn't close this deal, and then we moved on to other things. And meanwhile, business is suffering. We're not making any decisions about that. Then we do this strict foreclosure at the end. So it seems like the advice, the improper advice, is what was pled, and there's results along the way. It's kind of a trail of decisions or indecisions, or that's what it seems like how it's pled. So you're tying it to maybe a little differently than I have taken it, I guess.
I appreciate the insight into how you're approaching the issue, and I'd like you to reconsider that, to be candid, Your Honor,
yeah,
because
sure.
I don't think it's the right approach. I think in this context, in the Rule 55 world, you have to look really at the allegations in the complaint.
Sure.
And be very specific about what's there and what isn't to avoid the issue that many of the cases we've cited refer to as default not providing a blank check, right?
Absolutely.
There has to be a connection between the allegations and the complaint. There has to be proximate cause. The damages must flow from the allegations that are specifically
Absolutely.
Mentioned.
Absolutely.
And the enterprise value theory that's based on a loss of equity value just isn't in the complaint. They talk about other categories of damages,
sure.
but they don't talk about a loss of equity value.
Sure. And I'm asking you questions that I have, but I'll wait until you progress because I'll probably be able to ask them in a little bit because I want you to.
Great.
I want to not take up all your time. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I would like to talk about the causation failure issue, which is the buyout story. And big picture. There's no evidence that the buyout would have happened. So even if you set aside the limitations in the pleading on this subject, if you look at the record that the parties have submitted, it doesn't support the story that KIC is telling. They have to show that but for defendant's conduct, a sale would have occurred. That's their obligation. But the record shows exactly why that didn't happen. First, Solston wanted more money than KIC could afford. Second, KIC's board repeatedly concluded Solston's price was too high. Stephanie, you can put up tab 24. This is KIC 14. It's board minutes.
Which one are you on right now?
It's tab 24 in your book. You'll see halfway down there, Your Honor. This is, you also saw this morning. The board authorized Walter and Sarah to go over the numbers and renegotiations. Asking price from Jesse and Dwayne are too high. These are the board's minutes capturing the board's views. October 16, 2014, the board thought Solston's offer was too high. And that's consistent with what Mr. Lampe testified as the 36 witness for KIC. We put up in tab 17, we have excerpts from Mr. Lampe's deposition, the 36 deposition of KIC. And at page 92, lines 5 and 6, you'll see the discussion here. Well, that may be the wrong. It starts at 92.5 and continues through 95.6. So, we'll blow that up, Stephanie. Hard to read. Might be easier in the binder, Your Honor.
Right here.
On page 92, they're talking about the $8.8 million proposal at this point. You'll see a question at line 18. I think it's like actually 8.8 or something like that. Does that sound right? Answer, yeah, that sounds about right, between 8 and 9, I think something. Question, and that was too much, right? Answer, we believe so. After getting advice from both counsel and management, it did. It didn't seem like a price, especially when Marsh Creek was losing money. Question, well, they were good reasons, right? I mean, number one is Marsh Creek's losing money, correct? Answer, yes. Question, so why pour money into a company that's already losing it, correct? Answer, yes. Question, also to do a deal at that price, KIC would have to borrow a lot of money, correct? Answer, yeah, we'd pretty much have to borrow almost the entire amount. Question, and there would be interest in that amount, presumably, right? Answer, most likely. That's KIC's 30B6 testimony, acknowledging the price was too high.
Do you know what that was based on? This reads like, you know, we're sitting around a, this sounds like the, to use their metaphor, used car. What information are, where are we getting the information? Is it a report? Is it an appraisal? Is it, where's the lawyer getting the information?
The information that it's too expensive, or that the price is too high?
Right. I mean, these are like summary opinions, right? It's too high. $8 million is too high. Well, what's that based on?
It's based on the fact that KIC didn't have the money, and that KIC, their deponent admitted they would have to borrow all of the money, virtually all of the money, to be able to afford something like that. And we're sitting at a time where oil prices have dropped,
sure.
Government contracts are declining, they have graduated from the 8A program. The future is very risky for Marsh Creek at that point. So taking on 100% of the company means you're taking on 100% of the risk of its operational success at that point,
sure.
Which makes it less certain you're able to pay back any loans that you acquire or any of the financing. In addition, you're saddling yourself with interest payments that are substantial.
Yeah, and I understand all of that, but isn't that why the company, KIC, is hiring a lawyer to advise them on acquiring another company? Shouldn't that be one of the first things? How much can you afford?
I think that's it's fair to say the lawyers certainly have to take into consideration their client's ability to pay,
yeah.
And did so. And that's why the deal didn't press ahead. And because KIC itself realized it didn't have the financial resources to be able to reach the price that Solston was pushing.
Because one of the things I haven't seen yet is something that tells me that in the record, that here's our ceiling, we can't go above it. I just see yeses and noes, but I don't know what that's really based on.
I don't think you're going to see it.
Too high, whose opinion is that, and what is that based on? We can't afford it too high, or I don't want to pay that too high? Which is it? It seems like it's a, we don't want to pay that.
No, it's we can't afford it, Your Honor. And our expert affidavit from Paul Ficca walks through the financial circumstances of
KIC.
Right,
but I'd be looking at the board members, the lawyer giving the advice, those folks who are making decisions about this is too high. What are they relying on?
Your Honor, I can speak to the fact that their books show they lacked the financial resources to undertake this kind of a transaction at the prices that Solston was offering.
Yeah, and I'm just hoping that was communicated to the board, or the lawyer had a grip on that and he's communicating that to the board. There's a nice letter that says, based on the representation that you hired us for to look into this company, we're going to buy. We can't afford it because of X, Y, and Z, or we could afford it if we do A, B, C. Is there any communication like that that's kind of this nice?
I'm not aware of a written communication to that effect, but I'm not sure that is entirely the function of the lawyer to advise the client on their financial resources.
Then tell me that.
Yeah. I think that the clients, the entity, KIC and the board members, have their own fiduciary duties to understand their business and what their financial resources are and their capabilities to make investments. They are the decision makers on whether to acquire another company. They are the decision makers on how much they can afford. They have a lawyer who helps them negotiate to get the best price they can, and then they decide, do they want to go forward with the transaction? Here, the lawyer did exactly that. The lawyer helped them negotiate the price down substantially. It was still too high. And it's easy to, I think, understand in the context of the time period why this would be a problem for KIC. Because of the graduation from 8A, because of the decline in the oil prices, the risk involved in this company was significant. The heyday was past. There's a reason they want you to look at 2013 and 2015, not 2018. The world had shifted, both for Marsh Creek and for everybody involved in the oil and gas business. It had declined dramatically, and the ability to acquire these companies, or the motivation to acquire a company in this space declines when the reward is not going to be as significant and the risk is great. And all we have to do is look back at what actually happened here to see that Marsh Creek did, in fact, fail. And, Your Honor, we can also go to in the deposition of Mr. Lampe, same tab, 17, on page 95. Line 10, line 11, Mr. Lampe says, if we thought the price was reasonable, yeah, we could have agreed to any price, but we didn't think the price was reasonable. Question, and certainly at that high price, it would have been a tremendous risk for KSE, right? Answer, that's why we didn't agree to it. Time after time, Mr. Lampe and KIC have testified and acknowledged that the price that Solston was pushing was too high. It can't be a basis for any of the damage determinations in this case. Your Honor, that offer, the $8.8 million offer, was discussed at the July 1st, 2014 KIC board meeting. There's no evidence that it was acted upon at that meeting. And then on September 30, 2014, Your Honor heard about defendants floating a lower valuation for the discussion, the $5 million. Proposing that Solstice share should be valued around the $5 million with the BDO information. And discussions were continuing. And this morning there were questions Your Honor had about whether Mr. Van Borgen was involved in any of those discussions, and we'll direct you to H&K 211, which is not in our binder because we didn't anticipate those questions this morning, but is in the record. Showing that he is, in fact, copied and involved in the communications involving the BDO question and the $5 million valuation. And again, if we put up tab 24, KIC 14, which are more board meetings from October 16, 20. These are October 16, 2014. Again, we have the asking price from Jesse and Duane are too high, right? Your Honor, KIC Solston and Marsh Creek held meetings that were facilitated by the defendants in October and December to try and come to terms on evaluation for Solston's share in Marsh Creek in October and in December. And then ultimately, there were offers exchanged in August of 2015. KIC offered $4 million cash plus 25% of net income for 5 years to acquire Solston's interest. That's at tab 31, KIC 29. Solston countered with two alternatives. One was a $6.25 million plus 1.75% of gross revenue, and the other was $9.5 million in a lump sum. Solston also had additional terms, though, including remaining the exclusive subcontractor for Marsh Creek's contracts with the Army Corps of Engineers to plug abandoned oil and gas wells on the North Slope, which is a significant issue given the ICO Bay difficulties that we'll talk about in a few moments. KIC responded to Solston's counteroffer again on September 4, 2015. That's at tab 32. And this one, the terms were $4.5 million cash plus 30% of net income. And KIC indicated it would allow Solston at that time to remain the exclusive subcontractor.
I think that's tab 33, not 32.
Tab 33 is the Solston response. Tab 32 is the KIC proposal.
I don't see the 30% reference.
As the 30%
Yep, 32, if you look down the second bullet point, has the residual payments over the succeeding 5 years of 30% of net income.
There it is, yep.
Right, and if you think about it, Your Honor, the net income component, you see that the KSE offers have net income. The Solston proposals have gross income. When you're dealing in a world with a lot of risk, if you are taking away a percentage of the gross income, you're increasing the risk for the buyer. Right? You're taking money off the top rather than money from profit. So KSE would be taking on all of the risk of the continued operations of Marsh Creek under a gross income proposal. That's why it's making the net income proposals.
Didn't Dwayne Dudley have an opinion about that?
I'm sure he did, Your Honor.
What was that opinion?
I'm not going to speak for Mr. Dudley because he's not my client.
He had a letter or an email about it, about these offers.
That's the next tab, Your Honor, tab 33. I mean, the response is to reject KIC's view and to say basically that you could manipulate costs and expenses in a way that would adversely change net income. You can tell these are difficult issues. They require a lot of negotiation, and there was a lot of negotiation back and forth. Maybe we put up the demonstrative here. We have a timeline that can show you kind of the history of some of the negotiations back and forth.
I've been waiting for a timeline for...
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How many years?
Here it is.
Hey, there we go. And the people rejoice.
Your Honor, we haven't seen this in advance. I mean, I'm sure it's fair and completely accurate and complete, but...
it's just the demonstrative.
I know, but we haven't seen it.
Is this the only one, or are there others?
This is the only one. I mean, there are other slides of the timeline. This is the start of it.
Okay. Do you have a printout that you could show counsel, and then I can pause for a little bit?
I don't think we do have a printout. He's welcome to come over, and we can tab through it for him if you'd like.
How many pages is it?
Maybe 5 or 6.
Maybe just skip them.
If it's helpful to the court, I don't mind. I just want to point out that we didn't.
I think a timeline can be helpful for everyone.
Like I said, if it's helpful, we don't have an objection. I just wanted to point out to the court we didn't have a chance to review it or add anything into completeness or something like that.
Did you see the binders before we started today?
I know this. No, I was...
No binder? Did you see any binders at all today before we started?
This is insane.
No? Okay. So this is in the same category of everything else, I guess, what I'm trying to say.
Well, I've seen the exhibits.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Go until if there's a... error, just let me know.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we created it last night as we were preparing for the hearing. Yeah.
No, I think a timeline is going to be helpful. So
okay. So we go back to March of 2004 is when Marsh Creek was formed, with an initial investment of $95,000 by Solston and $102,000 from KIC. We cite to the documents that support the information there, HK1. For 9 years, while in the 8A program, Marsh Creek operates profitably and successfully. 2013, Marsh Creek graduates from the 8A program. We'll go on to the next one. June 2014, Solston makes that initial offer. That's the $12.5 million total, the combination of the $10 million AGC loan and a $2.5 million Solston loan. Shortly thereafter, Holland & Knight opens up a new matter to assist KSC with the proposed transaction. We saw that this morning from Mr. Slarsky. And then on July 1st, 2014, the board discusses that offer. On September 30, 2014, KSC proposes that alternative, floats that alternative number. It's not an offer. It's a number they're floating of a value of $5 million. Your Honor saw that this morning.
What does float different than offer mean?
There was no proposal that said we're willing to sell at this price. It was a here's a valuation that we'd like to have a discussion about.
Okay.
On June 26, 2014, the KIC board says in KIC 008 that the asking price is too high. In October through December, we have all those meetings that occurred that are reflected in KIC 15 and 16. And that leads to KIC actually making a counteroffer in July of $4 million cash plus 25% of net income. That's in KIC 29. A little less than a month later, Solston comes back with the proposal that we were just looking at. $6.25 million in cash plus 1.75% of gross income, or $9.5 million. That's the tab 33 document. September 4, 2015, another little less than a month goes by, and KIC responds increasing to $4.5 million and 30% of net income for 5 years. September 14, 2015, Solston makes...
Can I ask a question about that last one?
Yeah.
You know what the total valuation would be on the... So the $4.5 million cash, got that. But what would 30% of net income be over that time period?
I don't think we know.
What would that
zero.
Be?
Oh, that's he's right. It'd be zero because the company went negative in its cash flow.
In 2015?
Shortly thereafter. And Mr. Ficca's affidavit walks through that history and the decline in the cash.
So is that a real offer then? If it's offering 4.5 plus
right.
zero?
Well, right. So again, the premise behind all of this is if KIC acquires the company, it turns it around. Right, that it's able to requalify through take the assets, put them in a subsidiary, requalify for 8A, and try and make a go of it. Right, so that's the hope.
What percentage or what time frame is the 30%? Is that it's 5 years, right?
Yeah.
So year one is zero, but year two, three, four, five are maybe something.
Right. If they're successful in turning things around, you'd see over time the dollars would come up.
Was there a projection for what that would have been, or?
I don't know if there's a projection, Your Honor. I'm not sure we've seen one.
It seems like it doesn't seem like an offer if it's not, if there's not actual numbers to it. It's just kind of a, if at least right now today, year one is worth zero. So it's 4.5 million plus zero.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, what we know from valuations, 2013 and 2015 valuations for Mr. Gabehart, for example, is they're not very good at predicting what happens in the future, right?
I don't know, that 320-page document I looked at times two, it seems like it has a lot of information, not just about 8A, but everything else.
But
as far as what does it mean to the company and its value, its worth, and what can it do, and the industry.
Sure.
And
but it turned out to be wrong.
Right, but I mean, it's still an effort to try to have a handle on those things, so folks who are thinking about buying the company have a sense of what are the possibilities.
Sure. Solston's a pretty sophisticated party, Your Honor, and was involved in the business and understood exactly what was going on here with the company. And I think the parties all understood. I mean, I think everybody knows when a company graduates from the 8A program, it generally fails, right? Once you lose that preference, it is difficult to continue to compete for those federal contracts. So something had to be done to turn this around. The whole reason they're talking is to try and get to a place where the assets can be used and requalified for 8A to make a go of it, right? To keep all the employees, keep things going, keep generating money for KIC. So there has to be some sense that that's possible in order to make a proposal. I can understand why Solston would say, well, 30% of net income is not interesting to us, right? We'll reject that proposal. And likewise, I think one could understand why KIC would say gross income, a percentage of gross income is not attractive to us because we're starting at scratch and trying to build.
Go ahead. I don't have any more questions here.
Okay. And September 14, 2015, we have that final offer from Solston, which is, again, the A or B options, $5.25 million in cash plus $1.625 percent of the gross revenue or the $8.75 million. That's as low as they come. I think we got our dates wrong there on the next bullet. But KIC comes back with a proposal of $5 to $6 million.
which bullet is from?
Do you have the date on that, Michael? The one in the middle, the timing is off. August 10, 2015. KIC 35 is behind tab 36, Your Honor.
March 1st, 2016.
Okay, so March 1st, 2016. Okay. Just 35. Let's just go back to the...
I'll find it.
Okay. Mr. Gilmore will find it for me. Consider that timeline.
35?
The language I was looking for that I thought was in 35. Still looking for that, Your Honor. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to flag that the offer, the Solson offer, the 5.95 cash plus the 1.625 of gross revenue or 8.875. Mr. Dudley testified at his deposition, which is tab 14. At lines 122, 4 through 15. Okay. All right. We'll come back to that in a second. I'll make a note. Mr. Dudley testified that Solson wouldn't have taken any less than the 8.875 million or the 5.95 cash plus 1.625. Did we contemplate a lower price? Well, one would always contemplate a long spectrum to know where one might land. We didn't offer a lowering asking price. We and I personally felt like we were at the bottom of a band of potential valuations at this point in time. Keep going down a little bit. That's all we had on there? Okay, that's all we clipped. I'm sorry, Your Honor. But Mr. Dudley was saying that's as low as we're going with that offer, right? And the reason I'm going through these and talking about the differences is to show the level of interactions that were going on in the negotiations and the effort to get to a price. And Holland & Knight was certainly a part of trying to negotiate to get to a price. In order to get to a fair market value, as Mr. Solarski was talking about this morning, you have to have a willing buyer and a willing seller. And you have to actually meet at a price, and that couldn't happen here because the parties were too far apart.
What were the running orders that KIC gave to Featherly as far as here's our top price, or if we go cash, it's this, if we go not cash but partial cash, it's Y? Where is that?
I'm not sure that there is a document that reflects that.
So that's kind of the big elephant in the room, right? I mean, there's all this advice and yes and no's going back and forth, but what is it based on? What is KIC? How is KIC being advised by their lawyer to this is a good offer, this is too high, based on what?
Again,
if I'm buying a car, I have a budget, right? We buy a house, we have a budget. What's KIC's budget? What's the go-no-go? On these offers. I agree, there's offers going back and forth, and there's yeses and nos going back and forth. But why? Is it too expensive?
It's too expensive.
Is it based on the valuation of the... So it's not that KIC can't afford it. It's too expensive, meaning the value?
The risk is too great. And so, when you talk about is something too expensive or you can't afford it,
yeah,
they're kind of related concepts,
sure,
right?
Sure.
The idea there is, I might be able to go get a bigger house, and I might qualify for the mortgage, but 3 years from now, I might not be able to afford that. The weight of the debt could become crushing, right, over time.
Sure.
Yes, I have the ability to qualify for the financing right now, but the debt burden that I would take on might be ruinous ultimately. And I have to make that decision, not my real estate agent or my lawyer.
Sure.
I make that decision about my risk tolerance and my capabilities and my financial resources to be able to press ahead. And that's what happens here. KIC is trying to turn Holland & Knight, Mr. Featherly, into their insurer on a transaction. I can't imagine deal lawyers being required to guarantee to their clients that negotiations will always lead to a deal. And I can't imagine circumstances where deal lawyers are essentially required to give the other side a higher price than your client wants and can reasonably afford based on the risk they're willing to take on. It's through the looking glass in the analysis here of what the role of the lawyer is. The lawyer here is negotiating a lower price and moved the needle successfully in lowering the price, but it remained out of reach for KIC under the circumstances.
Why?
Again, because they were taking on 100% of the operating risk, they would not
didn't
have...
Didn't they want that? Isn't that the whole point of them hiring Featherly was to get Solston's 49% so they could control the company and it'd be worth more because it was 100% owned?
But you have
Isn't
to
that what the appraisal said?
Sure, but you have to have enough cash to make it go, right?
That's what was getting to my other point. It's at what point... What use is a lawyer who can't tell me I can't afford something, or if it's just about valuation, that's still about affordability too, isn't it?
Your Honor, I think if you looked at our expert affidavits from Mr. Feldman and Mr. Lee and Solomon, you would have a different view of the role of the lawyer in a transaction. The role of the lawyer is not to tell the client whether it has the financial resources to do a particular deal. The client needs to make that decision.
Sure, and I hope I'm not being misunderstood, and I may very well be, but it seems that the role of the lawyer is, if it's to negotiate a price, he should know when is it too expensive. Is it just valuation, or is it also affordability and the ability of the company to be solvent because they can afford it or not? It seems like it's both.
I think
But where's the interaction? Where's the, like when I see, when you point to the record here, the deposition, and the board member is saying, well, it's too high. It's like, okay, what's that board member relying on to say it's too high? It's probably the advice that they got from the lawyer, or it's from something that's in writing somewhere. We know that the appraisal gave a certain valuation twice, 2013 and 2015, fair market value, and you can figure out what the percentages are there. But now we're going way below that, and Solston was willing to go below that. So the go, no-go, it's just very confusing in the record. There's not much there. For a law firm as sophisticated as H&K advising a company that, as you say, is sophisticated itself, where is it? Where is the advice that's been given? When you pointed out the board meeting minutes, did you see what the item after this, we're going to deny this offer? The next one was supporting a school for
$500.
For $500.
Yeah, yeah.
That entry got as much play as the earlier one. I mean, it seems like it's just, to say that it's deficient, the record is deficient, is just, I mean, how many lawyers are in this courtroom? I mean, is that the practice? That's how we do it. That's how we document. That's how we consult. That's how we cover ourselves. We don't say that, but that's, I mean, documenting is key. And Mr. Featherly certainly does that in certain spots, right?
He certainly does
a nice job of saying what the law is and fiduciary duty and, you know, you need to do this in 30 days. And it's just, it's something that is just been, I want to find it, and it's just been fleeting, and it's just not there.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about accepting offers or not, it's just, it's very hard to track. It's very hard to track. And if there's a lawyer involved who's advising, well, where's the advice? Where is that?
Yeah.
I see the board making decisions, but it's not very helpful to me. It doesn't elucidate what's happening. Do you think it does historically? I mean, you look back and where is it? It's a lot of emails. I'll give you that. There's a lot of couple sentence emails about I wouldn't do this and be careful of that. And I mean, on these big issues, and I know there's shorthand ways of saying things and for those who are learned and all that. But when you're advising a board, and I see Sarah Curtis, we talked about it this morning. Sarah Curtis does a nice little letter to the board. Hey, here's an update. This is what we're doing. This is what the role is. So where is that?
The testimony in the case from both Cassie and from Mr. Featherly is that most of the communications were oral. That they were
discussion. Or even follow-up. This is the document we talked about at the board meeting.
Yeah, I absolutely understand the inclination, Your Honor, but the absence of a writing doesn't prove that the communications didn't
absolutely
exist.
Absolutely, but it makes me following you and what you're asserting difficult. It makes it difficult because what would be wonderful for all of us is documentation.
Yes, Your Honor.
There is some there, and it's not very good. It's not very supportive. As I've mentioned before, there's a lot of head scratching in this case. Not only how it was litigated, but as I read here, it's a lot of head scratching. Go ahead. I'm trying to give you some of my mind and where the gaps are and what I'm trying to solve, and maybe it's not solvable. And
we're going to try and solve it for you, Your Honor, and we'll keep working on it. And maybe we can just jump a little bit ahead here to some of the documents on KIC's inability to finance the deal at the prices that the Solston was seeking. And we just pull up Paul Ficca's affidavit, which is tab 8, and go to paragraph 22. he summarizes.
You said 22? You said 22?
Paragraph 22, okay. Tab 8. And that's Mr. Ficca. He's our damages expert on financial damages and valuation issues. And so in paragraph 22, he recaps the financial situation for KIC in 2015 and 2014 financial statements. KIC had only $340,000 and $20 in cash and cash equivalents on June 30, 2014, right? And I think we've already heard from others, and I don't think KIC would dispute that it would have to borrow most, if not all, of the purchase price in the hypothetical scenarios that Dr. Colt put on the table. And if you assumed the 6.25% interest rate on KIC's loan, those are annual interest payments of $611,875 on a purchase price of $9.79 million. That's scenario 1A. 1B, which is the 2013 valuation. 1B is the 2015 valuation. You'd have $515,438 of interest on that lower purchase price of $8.247 million. At that same time, KIC reported income before taxes of just $1.162 million. So the interest payments on the hypothetical purchase of Solston's 49% interest would have materially affected KIC's 2014 profitability. And in 2015, KIC had a loss before taxes and a declining business.
What is the offer that KIC made near this time frame?
In
your timeline?
I didn't print a copy of the timeline for myself even, Your Honor.
Let me pull up your timeline.
Yeah. Can you pull up the timeline again? So we want to look at 2014-2015?
Yeah. Just to get a sense of the offers going back and forth. June 30 is what? Of 2015.
Well, we have the previous offer in 2014 was the $12.5 million one.
You have anything in 2015? What's it say in 2015? So KIC offer 2 is $4 million. July 17, which would be a month after, well, 3 weeks after this, is $4 million cash, 25% income. How is KIC affording that?
Good question, Your Honor. Obviously, they would be financing at $4 million versus the $8 million. The interest is substantially less at 25% net income. They're only paying if the company is turning around, right, on the 25%. 6% interest or 6.25% interest on the $4 million is going to be less than half of what we were looking at on the Gay Part valuation amounts.
I guess the point is KIC is offering $4 million and $4.5 million in the couple months after this June 30, where the FICA is saying there's only a $300,000 in the bank.
Right.
So I guess what's the point of FICA's making that statement if KIC's been making offers for millions?
I think the point is the price had to be low and the risk had to be on the net income side, not the gross income side. Right. As I understand it, KIC did not have a lot of other significant revenue generating businesses, so had a significant interest in trying to turn the Marsh Creek assets into restore them to the profitable use that they had while they were in the 8A program. So, I mean, if you imagine the circumstances here, Your Honor, the sky is falling on this investment, right, for KIC. It had been very successful for them from that, as the timeline showed, you know, while they were in the 8A program from 2004 to 2013, very lucrative, very successful. And now something that they've counted on has started to decline, and they don't have a lot of other sources of significant revenue. So their best hope to get back to where they were is to try and acquire the assets at a dollar number that isn't going to completely destroy them, hopefully, and to turn it around. But buying the $4 million house instead of, I mean, that'd be a nice house, right, but instead of the $8 to $9 million house is a big difference. Right, and a big difference in the kind of risk that you're taking on in that circumstance. So that's the point of the FICA analysis there. In 2015, KIC had $1.1 million in cash, Your Honor, at that point, but it had a loss before taxes of $1.3 million. So they had enough cash at that point to try and do a low-dollar proposal. And just for context, Your Honor, in 2014, KIC had reported $1.37 million in income from Marsh Creek. And that led to a total of $1.16 million income in 2014 for KIC. And in 2015, there were $1.56 million in expenses attributable to Marsh Creek. So things had really shifted quite a bit during this time period. In Your Honor, in 2016, if we can pull up tab 40, this is H&K 66. These are KIC's financial statements from June 30, 2016 and 2015. And I don't have to take you through all of this, but if you look at the exhibit in your copious free time, you'll see the cash position and the cash equivalents in 2016 were declining from 2015 significantly. And KIC sustained losses in 2016 of $591,000 related to Marsh Creek in 2016, Your Honor. And we've heard about the proposal with AGC, and it's true that Alaska Growth Capital expressed interest in financing a transaction, but it's also true there was never actually an approved loan. There were no loan terms offered, not even a loan application that KIC can point to be in a position to close a deal or follow through with any of the particular proposals. And again, they have the burden of showing that but for Holland & Knight's advice or Mr. Featherly's advice, the deal would have closed, and the deal could have happened. And that's just not in the record. I'd like to go back and I flag just a couple of other issues that I think arose in the course of the negotiations. Because there were intervening events that derailed negotiations along the way. They stalled for a while in 2016 after Mr. Tikhlek, then the president of KIC, passed away unexpectedly. That slowed down some of the communications. Mr. Dudley, I think, acknowledged that. Mr. Featherly, Mr. Lampe also testified in their depositions that Mr. Tikhlek had played a central role at KIC in the negotiations between the parties. Those deposition excerpts, I won't try and walk you through them, but they are at tab 16 for Mr. Featherly and at tab 17 for Mr. Lampe. In particular for him, pages 97, 98, 99, on Mr. Tikhlek's importance to KIC. And you heard, Your Honor, this morning that KIC alleges that Mr. Featherly froze Solston out as a minority member. I'd like to talk just a little bit about that. If we can go to tab 55. Which is the arbitration award. In paragraphs 40 and 43, I should say.
It only goes to 40.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
It only goes to 40, the arbitration award? Paragraph 40?
Paragraph 40 through 43.
Sorry. All right, 40 to 43.
The arbitrator heard these same kinds of arguments that KIC has been making on behalf of, or the KIC is making today really on behalf of Solston, right? But here, this is paragraph 40 of the arbitration award. The arbitrator writes, but here Solston's claim of being denied a role in management is misplaced. As cited above, pursuant to Article 5, Section 1, the general management of Marsh Creek was vested in the managers. And he goes on to explain how the business runs and the operation of the business. In agreeing to the operating agreement, paragraph 42, Solston agreed to membership in an organization that it could neither control nor participate in the management of. To the extent that Solston harbored an expectation that it could participate in the management of Marsh Creek, that expectation was not reasonable. And Solston's exclusion from management does not justify a valuation date of March 31, 2015. He's rejecting the Gay Part 2015. And he goes on to explain that a valuation date of March 31, 2015 is not otherwise justifiable, distinguishing some of the cases as he moves through. The arbitrator, excuse me, I just about dropped my notepad there. The arbitrator specifically found that Solston's conduct during the period of negotiations cannot be justified. And went on, if you look at paragraph 32 of the arbitration award, talk about Mr. Dudley. Paragraph paragraph 32 on page 18, line 3, Mr. Dudley's conduct with respect to Marsh Creek's relationships with its lenders, and specifically with respect to his contacts with Joe Gellione at FNBA and Gene McKnight at North Rim, were contrary to the interests of Marsh Creek and breached duties he owed Marsh Creek as a manager of Marsh Creek. This conclusion is bolstered by Mr. Dudley's efforts at concealment.
Was this a response to what he was experiencing from KSC? Arguably, I mean.
I imagine that is what they would say. That's clearly not the way the arbitrator viewed the facts. He interfered with and impaired Marsh Creek's value, deteriorated the relationship with KIC through these actions by going to lenders and essentially making it impossible for Marsh Creek to continue to have a line of credit.
Other than here, where is it at in the record?
I'll have to ask my colleagues if they can find additional record sites. I thought the arbitrator's paragraph would be sufficient for Your Honor today, but I'll have to
contact
take a look.
Is always helpful.
Okay. We'll see if we can dig out something else there and supplement or tell you later this afternoon. I think what the record shows, though, and the arbitrator who plowed through all of these issues before, what this shows is a really messy situation. I don't think anyone can argue with that. You had conflict between KIC and Solston. You had a failing business that was really important to both companies, but particularly to KIC, and they were in an impossible position. They needed help, and Mr. Featherly and Holland Knight gave them an avenue to try and rescue the situation. The alternative was to let everything fail, and the investments all disappear for everyone.
Couldn't they have sold? Solston offered to buy KIC out, right?
They did, but at such a low dollar that it didn't make sense for KIC. And we also have, Your Honor, the ICO Bay issue as an intervening factor here in the efforts to work through a possible sale. And again, we're in 2016, where Marsh Creek's facing major losses, contract risk, and deteriorating cash flow. Your Honor's already heard what happened with ICO Bay. Solston was a subcontractor for the BLM, and there were significant problems, and the work had not been accomplished properly and had to be redone multiple times. Mr. Weiser, in his affidavit, explains the real challenges and the expenses that would be involved in trying to fix that problem. And I want to draw your attention to HK 74, because of something that was said this morning. It's not in the binders, because it came up in the context this morning with Mr. Slarsky talking about ICO Bay. If we were able to pull up HK 74. Oh, you got it.
Is that it right there?
It is. And
what's the date on that?
We're going to have to blow it up for me to see, too, of May 16, 2017.
Yeah. This is who to who?
Blow it up, Steph. What's that? So this is coming from Stoll Reeves to KIC. This is essentially Marsh Creek to KIC and Solston talking about ICO Bay and the difficulties. And the letter, just in substance, Your Honor, says you need to put your insurance carriers on notice about this problem. There are problems between between the two owners. There we go. That's great. In this regard, Marsh Creek requests that the management committee issue direction to Marsh Creek to notify its insurance carriers of a claim. In addition, Marsh Creek has contractual rights and remedies in its contract with Solston XP and seeks guidance related to the pursuit of these options, including notification to Solston XP's insurance carriers. It's a difficult position for Marsh Creek. its minority owner has functioned as a sub and done something that could be catastrophic for the company. Difficult issue for the owners to navigate and for Marsh Creek to navigate. And so not surprisingly, the management committee meeting scheduled for the next day had been canceled. This is what a functional company looks like and a functional management committee looks like, where the company says there's a problem, alerts the owners, encourages them to contact the insurers, and tries to sort out a very difficult situation. These ICO Bay issues created massive cash flow problems, potentially for the company. If we look at tab 18.
Before we come off of this, is this management committee the same one that Solson had been trying to have meetings with, and whether it's Featherly emails or others, just not been able to do it?
Correct, Your Honor.
Obviously, was this part of the reason with the management committee meetings not happening, that you don't really have a
conflict?
How does Marsh Creek be successful if the people that are supposed to manage it don't meet?
I think part of the issue is that because of the ICO Bay failures with Solston, Solston under the operating agreement became a defaulting member, right? And so,
I know that's the argument.
Yeah.
I'm just asking about the management committee. This is the same committee that Solston's a part of, or no?
Yes.
They've been trying to have meetings through Ms. Kale, and they haven't been able to have them.
Yeah, it is the same management committee, but as the passage from the arbitrator's order indicated, Solston doesn't have a role in managing the operations. Right.
No, I'm just responding to. It sounds like it's a good thing for the management committee to be meeting, especially for instances like this.
I think at that point it's a completely dysfunctional relationship, right? Where you have the two owners now need to go to their insurers because one of them has done such damage to the company.
I get that, but Marsh Creek is requesting the management committee to be coming together.
Yeah, but obviously they need to talk to their insurance carriers and figure out how they're going to do that.
Sure, but it seems, I don't know. Okay, I'll move on. Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to tab 18, Your Honor.
And then maybe let's take a break in just a couple minutes so I can just stretch a little bit. Everyone can stretch just a touch.
Okay.
If this is a natural place, we should just take 10 minutes or 5 minutes.
That's fine, Your Honor. Yeah, it'll take more than a couple of minutes to get.
Okay. We'll just do 5 minutes. I just need to stretch my leg. Okay, go ahead and please have a seat. And we're back on record, and I just want to say you're doing a nice job. I hope you can see I'm just trying to get some things clear. And I know you all are, some are not new in front of me, but I have to ask questions, so that's how I learn things. And it's not necessarily to give an indication of decisions. It's just things I want to try to get resolved if I can. So being a squirrel on a nut sometimes is part of it.
Yeah, I appreciate your honor. And, I mean, the most important thing for me today is to try and answer your questions and address them.
How are you doing on your time? Am I taking up too much of your time, or are you doing all right?
I'd say you've blown my outline, Your Honor, so it's kind of like all over the place. I'll do my best, and I appreciate your patience as well. As you know, I joined the case kind of late in the process, too, right at the end of discovery, and so I missed all the depositions and have read them like you, and so often have to turn to my colleagues to,
sure,
try and answer when you hit me with a zinger that I didn't expect. So thank you for your patience there. We were talking about ICO Bay before the break, and I don't want to belabor ICO Bay too much because I know the court is familiar with it and heard about it, but I'm going to just direct you to a little more in the record with respect to the challenges that ICO Bay created for Marsh Creek. We can go to tab 19. Did our monitor turn off? Up there. There we go. Okay, and this is the deposition of Mr. Strutz. If you go to page 135, and he was asked about the ICO Bay issue. You walk through at page 135, zoom in. Okay, the question, and according to your analysis of that, working with Mr. Lund, I guess the company, meaning Marsh Creek, spent approximately $5 million for this attempted remedy. Answer, uh-huh. Question, so there must have been payments from Marsh Creek to the Petroleum Resource of America. Answer, right. Those payments were not recouped from the federal government either. No, in fact, they never closed. They never actually closed the well. Right. That's where it said another additional $15 to $25 million. And that's probably what it would cost to drill a separate well and set off and drill into the pipe down below. You'd have to remobilize, put a drill rig, and that's a lot of money. Continues on the next page, on 136. A lot of money in the BLM wasn't going to pay for it. Oh, no. Okay, but it had cost, according to your analysis, $7 million already to the company, right? That wasn't going to get paid back, right? What was the effect of a $7 million loss to a company like Marsh Creek in that time frame? Well, it was already in decline. It was already losing money. It was kind of the nail that, question I was going to say, the last nail in the coffin. Answer, yeah. Is that what you say? Yeah. Yeah. So, and then, and the company was worth zero by March, basically. Is that right? Answer, right. Yes. Less than that, actually, is what I think. It was the answer. It's hard to overstate how important that ICO Bay issue was to the company, right? The company's teetering already. It's struggling. And then it's facing potential liability that's catastrophic and reputational harm as well, right? If you want to get federal government contracts and you've had a big problem with a BLM on a contract, good luck, right? And the ability to go down the road of ever requalifying for 8A and regain opportunities with the federal government would be diminished based on how Solston had handled the ICO Bay issues and the difficulties it had put Marsh Creek in. Mr. Weissert, our petroleum engineering expert, walks through the errors, Solston's errors and negligence in failing to properly plug the well. His affidavit, I'm not going to walk through it here, Your Honor, is at tab 13 of the binder that you received today. And at tab 38, you'll see the letter from the BLM that goes through the performance assessment report documenting the failure and ordering Marsh Creek to fix the issue. So even if a buyout had closed, the ICO Bay exposure would have followed the buyer, and it would have been devastating to Marsh Creek.
Is there anything in here, this letter, tab 38, that says that the contract with Solston should be canceled? Is that what it said in the other? Do you follow what I'm asking? I think it was Featherly's letter saying that BLM was asking or directing a cancellation of Solston's contract. Is that in this letter? Am I making sense or no?
I'm not sure.
There was a letter from Featherly to KIC can help me.
Mr. Gilmore.
Oh, to Ms. Kale. It was to Ms. Kale. And there were two, KIC is saying that there are two misrepresentations there, one of them being the BLM letter or BLM saying that Solston's contract should be canceled. Is that in here or is that somewhere else?
There was a meeting between BLM where that was the discussion.
Okay.
It's not
in the record?
It's not in the letter. I don't know where the meeting is. Is that Mr. Featherly's testimony? A Marsh Creek meeting with BLM. We'll have to look and see if there's a particular record site for that, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it might be in the McKay deposition.
Okay.
We'll have to check.
So just so I say it again, it was the Featherly letter to Ms. Kale, and there were two statements in there. One of them, that KIC challenges, one of them was that BLM directed the cancellation of Solston's contract.
I believe that's right. I don't have that letter in front of me to be.
So right now I have someone pointing a finger at you all saying that was a misstatement or a lie. So if you want to show me someplace where that's not, that would be helpful.
Okay. We'll see if we can find that, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you get a letter like the one at tab 38 from BLM that says the subcontractor has done something wrong of critical importance, and that this is the second major performance finding resulting from subcontractor performance deficiencies, that's a big deal. And one could imagine that BLM would take the next step and say, do not work with that subcontractor again. But we'll look for the specific site.
Sure. I mean, it's been out there. I'm not the first one to tell you that, right? I mean, it's been out there for a while.
Yeah, I think you're asking for the Kale letter.
So
Featherly.
What I'm referencing is Featherly writes a letter to Kale, and there's two statements in there. One of them that KIC, both of them, KIC is challenging. One of them refers to that BLM said that directed Marsh Creek or to cancel the contract with Solston. I might be getting that messed up, but that Solston basically should be canceled. The contract with them should be canceled. I can look for the letter. It's Featherly to Kale.
Okay, Your Honor, I'm going to attempt to switch over to talk a little bit about the valuation issues. I'm going to be mindful of time, so I'm going to make sure I hit everything. With respect to the valuation issue, KIC and Mr. Colt rely heavily on valuations that prove to be incorrect, right? The Colt valuation model in 1A and 1B, the enterprise damages, as they have characterized them, the loss of equity in Marsh Creek, assumes this alternate universe that never existed and makes any damages there highly speculative and improper. The appraisals that Dr. Colt relies on, he didn't validate, right, and he didn't conduct his own independent appraisals, and he made no independent effort to assess the value of Marsh Creek at any point in time, much less the extent to which any damages were purportedly caused by defendants, as opposed to all of these other factors that we've talked about, whether it's Solston, the declining oil prices, the graduation from 8A, the difficulties between the two entities and their principals getting along. And he takes at face value the historical valuations that Mr. Gebhardt provided in 2013 and 2015. John, the strongest evidence that these numbers are unreliable is that KIC refused to transact on them when it mattered. KIC can't reject a valuation when negotiating and now resurrect it years later as a damages model. Mr. Ficca, our expert, explains in his expert report between paragraphs 26 and 30 that Mr. Gebhardt's valuations were flawed. He used a proprietary approach that's not consistent with standard practices and lacks support in any authoritative literature. And he failed to account for the declining financial position that Marsh Creek had. And at the time of that second Gebhardt valuation in 2015, Marsh Creek's financial position had declined significantly with losses over $1 million. Again, that's back at tab 37, which has the KIC financial statements for 2015 and 2014, consolidated financials, which incidentally, Your Honor, obviously the KIC board is their responsibility to look at the financial statements and understand the cash position and their capabilities. It's not outside counsel and the lawyers' roles to do that in understanding what they can and can't afford. But back to the valuation.
Yeah, you know, just on that, I guess I'm not necessarily, when I ask the questions, I'm not necessarily saying it's the lawyer's responsibility to get the financing, but it would seem like, give me the bullets. Give me the tools I need to make this negotiation. What am I shooting for? If you tell me it's $7 million and I get it to $6.9 million, then I'm successful. But if you're not giving me that, then I can't do my job. So is there anywhere where Featherly is saying, you haven't told me what you can afford, so I can't do my job for you? If it's not his responsibility, it's theirs. So it just seems like there's a mystery of the negotiations and the reasons why the board believes it's too high. I mean,
I don't think there is a mystery, because they just, when you look at those financials and you realize they didn't have the money to buy the big house.
Today I hear that, but it seems like there would be decisions and conversations back then that we all can evaluate, and that's what's hard.
But they're just not written down, I think, is part of the issue.
Exactly. But it seems like they should be.
And certainly would
over
be
a period of years, it would seem. Yeah. There should. It seems like there should be.
It would be helpful. I acknowledge that, Your Honor. But again, the absence of the writing doesn't mean it didn't happen. And it is ultimately the client that decides their financial ability to invest in anything or to undergo a transaction. Sure. And it's the board, as part of their fiduciary obligations, they must understand their financial situation. And they direct the lawyer. It's not the lawyer directing the client. Those of us who practice civil litigation all the time, our clients will say, here's a settlement proposal, right? And they don't tell me what their top number is. They say, here's the settlement proposal. I don't know. I don't know how much they can afford to pay. I just know what they tell me to do and what their goals are, and I can advise them on the risks, and we move ahead. And we can't move to a world where the lawyers suddenly become the decision makers for the clients on these kinds of issues, or expected to be able to ascertain the risk that the client itself should be evaluating.
And unless that starts looking like the lawyer's taking on that role through a series of emails and whatever there are spotty emails and references from, you know, colleagues that are saying don't take these certain actions that the lawyer is advising on.
The lawyer's providing advice, yeah, with the lawyer's opinions for the client to make decisions.
Yeah.
That's the way the profession works.
Yeah.
And I think what we see in this record is a difficult situation for a client, right? I mean, a really difficult situation for a client with KIC depending on revenue and income from Marsh Creek and seeing it decline dramatically and having limited options on what to do about it. Looking for a solution and a lawyer trying to come up with a creative way to help their client. It may be high risk, but the alternative is you lose everything, and you are talking liquidation value, right? And ultimately, it's the client that makes that decision as to how to proceed. I got sidetracked there, Your Honor. I was talking about valuations.
Sorry, that was me. Go for it. Yeah.
Okay. And what I mentioned, you know, the number one reason I think the court should reject the Gavehart valuations as unreliable is that KIC refused to do a deal based on them. And so we can't bring it back now. Number two, right, the arbitrator rejected them as an appropriate measure of value at the time of the strict foreclosure in 2018, which was the passage I read earlier from the arbitration award. It's also important to note that Marsh Creek Management rejected the Gavehart valuations at the time. In tab 18, this is the McKay deposition. On page 176, blow that up. We go to lines, starting at line 22 on 176, going through 177.16. Okay, all right. Did you think in 2015 or 16 that 49% of Marsh Creek would be worth $5.95 million plus that's $500 million, $500,000 to $1 million going forward for the next 5 years? Answer, I thought that was too much. Question. Okay, do you recall seeing at some point a valuation that KIC had done of the total value of Marsh Creek and expressing an opinion about whether it was high or low? Answer, I saw it. I was given a copy of it sometime after the fact, and I thought it was high. Question. I think the value was like $25 million in 2013. Does that sound right? Answer, yes. Question. Your opinion, as far as you can recall, that was too high. Answer, yes. So you have the arbitrator rejecting valuations from Gavehart. You have KIC not using them as a basis for understanding its purchase price. You have Mr. Ficca explaining that Mr. Gavehart's methodology is not accepted methodology in the valuation world, not consistent with standard practices. And you have Marsh Creek's management themselves saying it was too high, it was wrong. And part of that, Mr. Colt then relies on this Gavehart series of two valuations for 1A and 1B of his report. And Mr. Colt makes unsupported assumptions that the acquisition would have automatically ensured continued success and profitability of Marsh Creek. He ignores all those other factors that I've talked about today, that Marsh Creek graduated from 8A program in August of 2013, and it couldn't participate ever again.
But the valuation was built on that, right? That assumption. It was already acknowledged pretty clearly up front.
Gavehart was. But Dr. Colt has the benefit of knowing what actually happened, right? He knows that Mr. Gavehart's assumptions as to how that would play out for Marsh Creek were wrong, and that, in fact, the business continued to decline precipitously thereafter.
So he didn't take that into account?
No. Colt simply takes the Gavehart numbers, the 2013 number and the 2015 number. That's 1A and 1B of his buckets.
We don't have to throw it up there, but when did the negotiations start? When did H&K join the effort and Featherly starts negotiating? What year, month and year? Was that October 2014?
I think it was June of 2014, I believe.
June of 2014. Okay, so June of 2014.
That was the Solston initial offer in 2014 of the $12.5 million.
And then it is basically done when? As late as 16?
I think the last offer was, March 17, 2016, I believe.
March of 20, I'm sorry, say that again.
March 17, 2016, St. Patrick's Day.
2016, okay. Okay. And when's the ICO Bay happen?
The BLM letter.
Where did I do it? I know I'm treating it like it's open forum, but sorry, I'm tempting all these lawyers who want to.
Well, I will take, I'll phone a friend here, Your Honor. 4/21/16 is the date of the BLM letter.
Okay. Okay. So negotiations were concluded by the time that letter comes out?
You're looking at a couple weeks after the last offer from Solston comes,
the letter at least. But when does it happen? ICO Bay, the failure. It'd probably be well before that, I imagine.
I think the failure was well before that. Was it a year before? No?
No, I think that was the first.
That was the first notice of it?
Of the failure, and then there was an attempt at remediation, and then that failed.
Okay.
I see.
So that was
BLM's
the first notice.
BLM is on these letters, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Serious issue.
Yeah. And Your Honor, just for clarity, in the event, if Solston had been successful in, if KIC had been successful in buying out Solston, KIC would have had to undergo the same process of setting up all the new 8A subs or contractors that KIC ultimately did with Kaktovik Environmental and the three other subs. And as we saw with the description of the 8A effort to create new 8As in the subs, that process is not guaranteed to be successful, regardless of when it occurred or who the buyer was in that sense. But Dr. Cole assumes immediate reentry into 8A. He also assumes they will get contracts successfully, which is a big assumption given ICO Bay. He assumes no financing drag on the company, having taken on debt, and no operational disruption. And we did, I'm not going to stray, I'm mindful of the court telling us what he wanted to focus on today, but with respect to the 8A issues, the Ford affidavit, which is in tab 10, is our expert who explains that entry into the 8A program is complex and not a sure thing. But Dr. Colt just assumes that it would happen under 1A and 1B and their enterprise value theories. So it's a series of assumptions that are stacked on each other for Dr. Colt to come up with his number and for KIC to come up with its loss of equity value claim. He never explains how the defendants are actually responsible for the loss of all the value in Marsh Creek, given all of these other circumstances that are going on, plus the high purchase price expectations for Solston and Solston's unwillingness to take on future risk by being willing to take a deal that includes a component that's net income. To the extent the court wants to look more at ICO Bay, I'll just tell you a few citations in the binder without walking you through all of them in the interest of time.
Well, I guess I'll just say that you've presented today that ICO Bay is related to valuation. I haven't heard much about what KIC's argument is, that Featherly is using this as a straw man for lack of fiduciary responsibility that KIC would owe to Solston. You haven't really touched on that. So
I haven't, Your Honor, because I thought that was outside the scope of what you wanted me to talk about, so I didn't want to go there.
I think so.
Because the pages you directed us to were enterprise.
Oh, it might have been the way that...
I think it was good for their section.
It was, right. Well, I don't want to hit you right now with that. So maybe that's something that we have to address on Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. We'll come back to that. And we've talked about Aqua Bay. We've talked about the death of Mr. Tikluk. We also know there were changes in Anwar at that time with whether Anwar might be opened or not opened and the change in administrations. And all of those can have an effect on Marsh Creek's ability to be successful. And the decline in oil prices, which Mr. Ficca discusses in tab 9 of paragraph 56 of his report. And Dr. Colt also doesn't account for how the businesses were actually managed by the KIC employees. They're the ones running the company. Holland & Knight is not running Marsh Creek. It's not running the subsidiaries. It's not making the decisions about where to invest, how many employees to have, and how to actually manage the operations of the company. There's no consideration, certainly not in the complaint, and also not in Dr. Colt's analysis, as to what the actual people running the business have to do with the success or failure of those businesses. Well, I would like to take credit for the success of my clients' financial or businesses. I know that they are the ones responsible for it. And a good example of this is at tab 50 in your binder. That's KIC 166. This was an email from Robert Masulich at Holland & Knight to Roller and Tompkins. And he's, I'm not going to walk through all of it, but the final blow to Kaktovik Environmental, one of the company subs that was spun off, was a statement by Brian Lund, who was a Kaktovik Environmental employee, that caused the Army Corps of Engineers to immediately terminate the contracts. And that disrupted Holland & Knight's plan to finish executing the contracts as a subcontractor. He jumped the gun. And Holland & Knight had understood that there was very little work left to be done. And that set things back significantly. Despite this and other business decisions, Dr. Colt attributes the entire loss of value of Marsh Creek to the defendants. That's not appropriate. All right, Your Honor, I'd like to turn the last section in our trial brief that you asked us to address was the double recovery concept. So I want to make sure we don't run out of time before we get there.
So let me catch up to you here. Pages 43 through 48. So let's just see where we're at. So C, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Starting at
Well, double recovery is D, and we don't need to touch on that. But C, yes. And I think you've already covered that.
Oh, I see.
It's A1, B, and C on pages 43 through 48.
Yeah. D starts on page 48, so we thought you wanted to talk about that too, Your Honor.
No, I don't think so. Okay. If you prepared it.
I sure did, Your Honor.
Then go for it. You have time.
So. Okay. We'll just, we'll talk about it for just a little bit here, Your Honor. The issue here, right, is are the buckets that Dr. Colt has. He's got Category 1, which are the loss of equity value, which does not appear in the complaint. And our point is that if you take those buckets, 1A or 1B, and you added them to Categories 2 through 7, you'd have a double recovery. Because the same KIC assets, KIC seeks to value at their peak in 2013 and 15, were taken in the 2018 strict foreclosure, and they were valued again by the arbitrator in 2021, who found there was no going concern value, and the fixed asset value was $8 million. I think that's one of the items that Your Honor asked about this morning, the value of KIC's interest based on the arbitrator's decision. It had $4.1 million worth of value, right, already, or it had $4.1 million, and then it had to pay $3.9 because it had taken the rest, which was Solston, the value of Solston's interest. Now where we sit, KIC is seeking its 51% share of Marsh Creek at peak value, plus Solston's 49% share at the 2018 asset value, plus the fees and costs paid from liquidation of the same assets. It's not compensatory damages. It's multiplying the damages. The events, as they've transpired over the last several years, last decade, and our experts' testimony show that the Gabe Hart valuation, both of them were fatally flawed. We know the price he put in 2013 and 2015 on Marsh Creek's contracts, liabilities, employees, and its equipment. We've got lists of every dump truck, generator, and laptop. And it was these
things. What was that number?
They're reflected in Mr. Ficca's report. I don't have all of them split out individually.
And that might not be a fair question. I apologize. But trading, the arbitration award said $8 million.
Right, right. $8 million is ultimately where the arbitrator landed for the total value, right? And that Solston's 49% interest was $3.92 million. And it's I understand it's a slightly difficult concept to grasp, but you can't have the compensatory damages based on what actually happened plus compensatory damages for an alternative world where none of that happened. You can't be paid for the house you tried to buy, the house you took, and the furniture from inside that you sold three times for the same property. It would give a windfall to KIC here. They would get the value of the 51% share based on a 2015 valuation that we and the arbitrator think is unreliable, plus Solston's 49% value as valued by the arbitrator, plus all the fees and costs paid with the value of assets once belonging to Marsh Creek and ultimately sold by KIC. That's double counting.
Other than saying this number is wrong, has H&K offered an alternative valuation?
An alternative valuation of it.
Under either 1A or 1B? If Gabe Hart is incorrect in both 2013 and 2015, does H&K offer an alternative valuation?
We'll talk about tomorrow the different buckets, I think when we're going through the UTPA 1 through 8, but there's not an alternative valuation number for 2013 or 2015 advanced by defendants.
I'm a little wanting because you're saying, well, the numbers are wrong there and the numbers are wrong there, but I don't have – so what's the number, do you think?
I think we all have to live with the arbitrator's decision on this as to what the value of the company was at the strict foreclosure time. And the issue that I'm addressing is that you can't do that plus say pay us for the loss.
No, I get that.
Right. And then when you go to the arbitrator's numbers – and we're living in a world where we're trying to figure out compensatory damages, we also have to take into consideration the set-offs, the fact that ultimately KIC was able to sell a lot of assets to reduce the amount that it actually paid out of pocket. And Mr. Ficca walks through all of those categories. They include the Kektovik Environmental's assets were sold to Bryce Environmental for $1.4 million. That's at tab 51. You'll see KIC 167, a Rexford email regarding the asset sales and payments, and the Ficca report at paragraph 121. The asset purchase agreement itself is also at tab 49. In addition, there's $1.2 million in equipment. KIC sold two water trucks for $430,000 in September of 2018. and various other equipment between January and July 2019 for a total of $795,179. That's in the FICA report at paragraph 121. That's tab 9.
Say the paragraph again.
Paragraph 121. And then H&K 165, which is at tab 45, also shows the accounts receivable cash receipt. And tab 46, which is H&K 209, has an itemized list of asset sales.
Is there a way to track that we're talking about the same assets? So truck in 2015 is the same truck in 2018 is the same truck in 2020, or is it just an amalgam of trucks?
I think we can go back to the previous valuations and see that they flow and that Mr. Ficca is analyzing from the same apples and apples.
Okay.
There's also real estate valued at $1.08 million. So all of those things have to be taken into consideration as well in trying to understand compensatory damages here. And what the actual loss was that KIC suffered if one assumes liability in the default context. So just finally on the duplication side, KIC is claiming damages for its fees and the fees paid to Mr. Strutz, the consultant who helped manage Kaktovic Holdings, the subsidiary, and liquidated the assets. But the record shows that Strutz was paid out of the sale of holdings and environmental assets, not by KIC out of pocket. KIC can't recover the loss of the Marsh Creek value, which includes all of those assets, and recover the fees that are paid by the sale of those assets as well. KIC got value out of Mr. Strutz, who succeeded in getting in Mr. Rexford's email at KIC 167 at tab 51, getting virtually all creditors to take substantial discounts as well. So, Your Honor, just given that we've been going for 2 hours, I'll close where you asked us to focus on pages 43 through 48 and with what Rule 55 actually allows. We understand it's a damages-only hearing and that default establishes the liability as pleaded. It doesn't establish the new theories, new transactions, or new damages. And a default does not give plaintiff a blank check. The plaintiff here is asking the court to award tens of millions of dollars for a deal that never closed, at a price never paid, using money they never borrowed, for a business that ultimately failed, while ignoring what KIC actually received through the arbitration, through the strict foreclosure, and through the ultimate sale of the assets. Rule 55 does not permit that result. And Alaska law does not permit that result. Enterprise damages, as characterized as the loss of equity value, have to be denied here, Your Honor. Is there anything else the court would like us to address this afternoon?
I don't think so. I would like to have a discussion about Wednesday. And I want to thank both of you and for everyone who's been involved in preparing you all today. I know it wasn't just the three folks that I heard from today. I think it's been quite a few more folks than that. So thank you for all the work that you're doing. I know it's not easy. So I guess for Wednesday, double recovery, I don't think you touched on that.
Your Honor, I do have a few rebuttal points if the court would
like to. I want to get to those, but I'm trying to think of the way to do that.
Got it.
As I mentioned, what you all are here to do is to help me understand your submittals, and I think you've done a nice job of doing that. I have some work ahead for sure. Some things were gone over that I was expecting, and I'm comfortable with my understanding. There's other things that I want to revisit, so I will do that. So I think what's going to have to happen is, as I mentioned before, tomorrow morning I will let you all know kind of where the rub is for the court. And I completely realize that for the lawyers, you're used to rebuttal, you're used to being able to, and it's not natural what we're doing because we're in a different setting. And I fully realize it's not very satisfying right now. But remember, I'm your audience, and you're doing your part to help me understand your filings. That's what I'm focused on. So what I'm going to do is take a look through my notes tonight and see where I have continued questions. H&K went some places I wasn't necessarily expecting, and I think it's part of me allowing, I know it was limited to the pages, but I think there was kind of an expansive view of that. I'm not saying he did anything wrong. It's just there's more to consider there because I'm listening to what you're saying. So I'm going to consider what was presented. So it'll take me a little bit to get through that. Tomorrow morning. So we'll start at 9.
Your Honor, will I get a chance to make any comments at all on this?
For the damages hearing? I didn't know that you were going to present because H&K is still being represented by Davis Wright Tremaine and by Cashin and Gilmore, so as to damages. So my understanding is that you were filed an entry for kind of a limited purpose dealing with the insurance and those issues. So that's not what today is.
I'm dealing with the conflict of interest. And one thing in particular today, on the 8A arguments that were made by plaintiffs, it was very interesting. It was about Mr. Musilich, it was by Sarah. It wasn't Mr. Featherly that was advising on those 8A damages.
Yeah, and I hope that you're having conversations with H&K and with Cashin and Gilmore and there's other lawyers that are involved in this. If it's about representation, you're raising a representation issue, and I have two firms that are continuing to represent your client. You're the third firm that's representing your client. So, as to damages, you're late to this, and you present from a different standpoint that I've already ruled on, which was primarily a motion to continue trial. You haven't filed a motion to reconsider. I mentioned that this morning. If you would like to do that, you're free to do that. There's a time frame to do that. And I would certainly consider any written filing, but as to damages, we're well underway. So I'll leave it to you to talk to the lawyers that are representing your client. That's all I have to say at this point. So tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. And as far as tomorrow, day two, oral argument on applicability scope of UTPA to the claim damages. Hour per party, and then KIC will have a rebuttal up to 15 minutes. And then 1 to 3 is A and B as the punitive damages. We'll do the same thing, hour each side. And then I'll ask questions along the way. Okay. All right. And again, I want to thank you all. We'll be off record.
Awesome.